Talk and the Good Food Hour are brought to you by the Santa Rosa Original Certified Farmers Market. In the KSRO kitchen, it's Sir Ham's-a-Lot, Chef John Ash on this Easter Day weekend. I don't know. That wasn't very good.
That was good.
No, I was going to call you Spiral Cut Ash. A lot of people are focused on Easter. We'll give, a shout out to Easter and some of the ideas that John has for this springtime weekend if you haven't focused on a menu and made it complete.
So let me ask you. How did ham become the meat, the protein of choice for Easter?
I don't know the answer.
I don't either.
I think and ham was always popular when we were growing up. I know that a ham was a centerpiece. Some people, though, did turkey, as I recall.
Yeah.
It was either turkey or ham. Turkey was kind of, and that it was usually, what I recall, was turkey Thanksgiving, and then it was a roast for Christmas,
yeah.
A roast. And I guess they wanted to do something different, maybe for spring, or maybe the American Ham Association did such a skillful marketing. Put up some money. And once canned hams came in to being, that you didn't have to go to the local butcher and all that.
So
it became so convenient.
So to that point, would you eat a canned ham?
I have eaten it. It's not anything I would buy.
Yeah.
I don't really care for them. I think they're... I don't think they're very appetizing.
No,
but I grew up, of course, in Kentucky eating smoked country ham.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Now, that's a ham. That's a ham. And so that's my idea of ham versus, although we have some very good hams done in California. Journeyman Meats brought in a wonderful ham for us a few months ago, and they do a traditional style ham.
Yeah.
It's really great. But as far as ham just blanketing the Easter tables, I don't know how they did it, but it has to do with some Madison Avenue marketing scheme.
Those honey-baked people. Huh?
They kind of taken over.
Yeah.
Taken over, and they're foolproof.
Yeah, that's true.
Warm it up, it's going to come out perfectly. Yeah. So I think that's part of the reason. It's not.
But there must be some, must go back to, to the hams that you had in Kentucky that were cured over a long period of time, hung in the smokehouse for 9 months and stuff like that.
Well, I think a lot of people didn't have access to those also.
Okay, so I want you to just share, because you know better than I do, your favorite, if it's too late to get it now, but your favorite country ham.
I would say the folks from Meacham's in Kentucky, they're a third generation ham place right outside Louisville. There's also Father's Ham, which is also a Kentucky ham, which we had them on the show.
Yeah.
Newsom's.
Yeah.
Newsom's ham is a great ham. Not in Kentucky, but it's a great ham also. There's probably three or four. Look for the, if you go to the website, there's an American Country Ham Association. And do you remember that we had Merle Ellis?
The butcher
on the show. This goes back 30 years.
Yeah.
Merle was the president of the American Country Ham Association.
Whatever happened to Merle?
Merle passed, but he wrote the butcher column in the San Francisco Chronicle for many years.
Yeah.
And back in 1991, 1992, we had Merle come on the show, actually a couple times, and talk about country ham and why it was such an important part of American culinary tradition.
Yeah.
And it took for years for people to catch on.
Yeah.
Really, it wasn't.
Well, unless you were from the South.
Unless you're, and there was, this was before Gold Belly. This is before we could have overnight country hams from Missouri shipped to us in 24 hours. The last 15, 20 years, country hams, I think, have risen. They're to the high point of understanding.
So here's the final question I'll ask you about that. What's the difference, eating quality of a country ham versus a regular ham?
It doesn't taste like water.
Yeah.
Basically, I think most of the cooked hams, They taste like ham, but they taste spongy to me, and I don't like that spongy flavor. I like something that's dense, that's meat, that tastes a flavor of what the pig actually ate.
Yeah,
there should be overtones of acorn. There should be a corn and acorn and grain flavor to the ham, plus a skillful smoker.
Yeah,
not something that like you're putting a cigarette butt in your mouth. Well, unfortunately, some of them really oversmoke their hams. So this is a tradition that has been nurtured and carried generationally for 150 years, 200 years in that part of the world.
Yeah.
So when I eat a ham, it's never really on Easter, I will order country ham online and always have some in the freezer.
Yeah.
So I'm going to do ham and eggs. That's how I'm going to do it. So moving from ham to lamb, you're a big fan of lamb,
yes,
you've written about lamb a lot, both in the newspaper and on your John Ash website, too. I don't know how much we do with lamb here, even though we've got world-class lamb producers. How many people will be serving lamb tomorrow at Easter?
There is a reason for that. It's the Lamb of God, you know, that kind of thing, so that there is some tie to Easter. I don't see that with ham, but that's another story.
Well, you've written a couple of recipes that I can reference. One was a spring lamb with salsa verde.
Uh-huh.
That was one of your most popular recipes, and that is, you have to do the eight bone rack of lamb.
Yeah, but you can, you know, what's really interesting, if you go to a regular butcher and buy rack of lamb, it can be kind of breathtakingly expensive.
That's right.
But our friends, and I don't mean to, well, I do mean to promote them, because that's where I get them from time to time, is go to Costco. And they bring in Australian and New Zealand lamb that's infinitely cheaper, and it's really good.
Well, that's
the racks, and then you can.
And you mentioned, why did ham become so popular? Look at the price.
Yeah,
you can look at these supermarkets, and for $1 a pound, you can get ham for Easter.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really inexpensive. I'm not vouching for the quality versus lamb, which is a more expensive and labor intensive product, and not done on a huge commercial scale like ham is done. But I like that you've shouted out the New Zealand hams. They're very good quality.
Yeah.
And they're affordable.
Yeah.
And the recipes that you did, one features spring lamb with rosemary, and one is with a salsa verde.
Uh-huh.
How do you put what is the salsa verde made from? How does that work?
Well, salsa verde is a classic herbal olive oil and herbs sauce, you know, that you can, and you can put more mint in it if you want to, but it's typically just green, fresh herbs, not dried, parsley and chives and things like that are ground up, obviously lots of garlic too, that are just ground up with the olive oil.
Is the rack of lamb a forgiving cut?
It is. The key to it is not to overcook it. So this is when, and we've talked about this before, you get yourself a instant read thermometer, because you don't want to overcook it. Then it becomes kind of dried out. And it's the thing that people sometimes complain about with lamb, that it takes on a gamey flavor. But if you keep it rare to medium rare, it's one of the most sublime meats in the whole world.
Well, and what you do, it's interesting, you sear this in a cast iron pan before putting it in the oven.
Yeah.
And so you're putting your seasoning on, and then you just, why do you do that? Did you get a crust?
To get a crust to develop some flavor. But there's another technique now used called the reverse sear. And this is a little more foolproof, and that is that you put it in an oven with relatively low heat, you know, 275, 300 degrees, get it to the temperature that you want. This is when your instant read thermometer comes in. Then when you're almost there, you pull it out, and in the cast iron pan, sear it very quickly to develop the crust and all of those wonderful flavors that are there, reverse searing. So rather than searing going in, it's searing coming out.
Well, you've obviously done both methods.
Yeah.
What do you prefer?
You know, I think I now prefer the reverse syrup. You know, because it's more foolproof. You won't overcook the lamb, and there's nothing. Well, I shouldn't say nothing worse, but it's just a tragedy to overcook, especially a rack of lamb. Which okay. Are the,
so if you haven't quite decided, this would be a great choice for tomorrow.
Yeah.
And you mentioned a 2 8-bone rack of lamb, Frenched. Now, will they, the ones you buy at Costco, will those
they're
be Frenched?
They're Frenched already, which just means that all of the fat and things like that are on the bones that extend from the meat are all cleaned off. So they look cool. And you're not getting a lot of lamb fat.
And just cut through and serve
yeah.
with the salsa verde on the side?
Cut them into chops, and there you go.
Okay, a good choice. And then, of course, I'm sure you've seen in the markets, finally, big, beautiful, fat spears of asparagus. Not these spindly little ones that look like a pipe cleaner. Ooh, never liked those. And the market is flooded with them. The price is really good. You also included in that spring recipe package, I like this one because you include an egg in this one. And this is cool. Grilled asparagus salad with pancetta and egg. So how does that go together?
Well, I think you described it. That is, I think in that recipe, as I recall, I grilled the asparagus. So the idea of grilling asparagus is that it doesn't develop that tendency toward asparagus, I shouldn't say this, asparagus pee.
Yes,
we know. When you eat asparagus, you know how later on when you go pee, it smells funny and all that stuff. Well, if you grill it, it doesn't do that. And also it cooks very quickly, and you can do it ahead and set it aside. And then when it comes time to serve it, take some pancetta or bacon and cook it up until it's crisp. Fry an egg. Put it all on top. And
gosh, it sounds wonderful. And you serve this with a spring salad.
Yeah.
Along. So
you
cook your pancetta.
Yeah.
And then does that go on top of the salad?
Yeah.
And then does the asparagus go on top of the salad?
Yeah.
Oh, it's all. And then the soft-boiled egg?
Yeah. You can do a fried egg, a soft-boiled egg, whatever.
Oh, I love this idea.
Yeah.
That sounds, I'm going to have that for breakfast tomorrow morning. One other asparagus recipe, which you also included in this recipe package, was white beans and grilled asparagus crostini. Is that more of an appetizer or that?
Yeah, but if you have enough of them, it's enough for a course.
It is.
And it's sort of fun to have the asparagus. Again, you can grill them because I think they have more flavor. They're sweeter that way. And then a puree of white beans, which can either be canned or something you cook from scratch. I think in that recipe I use cannellini, which I like because they're like a really great mashed potato, and you just pile some on the crostini on the little toast and asparagus on top of that, a drizzle of olive oil.
And I like you add a little parsley and a little bit of mint, and boy, what a...
They're so simple.
So there's a few recipes which we'll post later today on the KSRO Good Food Hour, courtesy of Chef John Ash. After a quick break, we're going to do a shout out to Lumpia.
Engage in discussions that matter.
The more we talk about it, the better.
KSRO, Sonoma County's News Talk.
This is KSRO's Michael O'Shea, personally inviting you to Malm Fireplace Center, sponsor of the Warriors. I own an Enviro fireplace from Malm. It is amazing on our chilly winter nights here in Wine Country. Unless you're a longtime Sonoma County resident, you may not know that Malm also manufactures freestanding wood burning and gas fireplaces. They can satisfy your burning desires. Family owned and operated since 1960, Malm Fireplace Center in Santa Rosa, on the web at malmfireplacecenter.com.
SoCo Private Security is a local family-owned business based in Santa Rosa. The new management team has over 5 decades of security service. Whether you need fixed site, vehicle patrol, or special event security, SoCo Private Security can help. Shopping centers, HOAs, private residences, banks, hotels, and more have enjoyed peace of mind with SoCo Private Security since 2013. More info at SoCoPrivateSecurity.com. SoCo Private Security, the new breed in security.
Does your business need advertising but cash flow is a challenge? Then contact us at the My Sonoma Deals program. It's a cashless program based on trade. Are you a restaurant, a golf course, a boutique, car wash, bowling alley, jewelry store, or florist? There are so many categories. Contact My Sonoma Deals now to find out if your business qualifies. Just go online to MySonomaDeals.com and click on contact. That's MySonomaDeals.com and click on contact.
When you're looking for a dining experience that's packed with flavor and fun, try Simmer Claw Bar. Southern-style boils with a Cajun twist are their specialty, and they're confident you'll love them too. But they're more than boils. The menu features fresh seafood, delicious sides, and a variety of craft beers on tap. With a large seating area and multiple televisions, enjoy the flavors of the bayou at Simmer Claw Bar. It's a perfect night out with friends and family. Text SIMMER to 85100 for a special discount.
There's a 180-square-foot shack on sale in Palo Alto for $2 million.
How'd you know that?
I heard it on the radio.
In a national survey of outside-the-home usage, the internet was used 42%, mobile phones 56%, and radio used 75%.
Brought to you by Amaturo Sonoma Media.
News anywhere. Stream KSRO from your smartphone or smart speaker. KSRO, Sonoma County's News Talk, FM, AM, and online.
KSRO, AM, FM, and online. Depend on it.
In the KSRO kitchen, I'm Steve Garner, along with Chef John Ash, celebrating our 37th, 38th year on the air, America's longest-running radio food program. And in all this time, I guess this is a recent phenomenon, and we kind of pride ourselves in at least having a pretty good overview of what's happening in the world of food. But we certainly didn't know, I didn't know, about the popularity of lumpia eating contests in the past few years. Did you know about that?
No. So what are lumpia?
Well, my understanding, I've been to Filipino restaurants and I've ordered lumpia, and I think of them as kind of a Filipino-style egg roll.
Yeah.
And they're not identical to the Chinese style that we're used to, and I know they use kind of a slightly
similar.
Different.
That's a good description.
But they do use a similar wrapper, and I kind of did
a
little
variety
research.
Of fillings.
All kinds of fillings, and there's some wrappers that have wheat-based ones. Of course, there's rice-based spring rolls. It's a huge world. You go to Taiwan style, to Malaysia style. We could do a whole show, and maybe we will, on egg rolls around the world.
Oh, that would be great.
But the Filipinos have adopted this, and it's become very popular around the country. They started, actually, there's ones in January, there's ones in March, there's ones in the Christmas, and there's one today, which is a little bit late to the party. It's the South Bay's only lumpia eating contest, happening in Milpitas today, the second annual lumpia eating contest. And this is in the San Jose area, of course. They're doing it again. And this is, they're going to determine who's going to be crowned the Bay Area's king or queen of lumpia. The winner last year devoured 30 rolls in under 5 minutes. 30 lumpia in 5 minutes. So about six per minute. That's a lot of lumpia to stuff down your throat. So they're doing this in Milpitas today. I'm sure it'll be fun. And it's being sponsored by the Lumpia Company, which is E40's Filipino food enterprise in the Milpitas area. So that was the one that I found out. I thought that was pretty cool. Just a family-friendly event that the whole family can enjoy. Here's another one that took place on the 16th of March down in Southern California in Canoga Park. Have you ever been to Canoga Park?
Yeah, I have.
Oh, yeah.
I have, yeah.
Any particular reason that comes to mind?
Well, probably driving through.
Well, it's their third annual lumpia eating contest there in Canoga Park, which I guess is in the Granada Hills area. Uh-huh. So they did this big one. There's also one that took place in January of this year, Lumpia 2024. And this one happened in, where was this one?
In L.A., yeah.
In Los Angeles proper. And listen to this, $25 per entry for contest, unlimited Lumpia for diners with a lunch order of a minimum of $15. So if you order a $15 lunch, you can also eat as many Lumpia as you'd care to.
So do we have Filipino restaurants
we do.
Here?
We do. We do. There's a few in Sonoma County.
We should...
maybe they'll sponsor a Lumpia eating contest. Yeah. Why shouldn't Sonoma County have one? And now here's the granddaddy of them all, which I didn't know about, happening in New York. Now listen to this. This happened last October. It'll happen again this October, the Lumpia eating contest. And this is happening at Broadway and West 79th Street in New York City. Well, listen to this guy. The Lumpia King, Wayne Algenio, will be competing again. He won, this is the record that still stands, the 2022 Lumpia Eating Competition. The new world record demolished 69 Lumpia in 10 minutes. Can you believe it?
Yeah.
Let's ponder that while we get ready to talk with our next guest.
Okay.
And I wonder what she might have to say about this. Yeah. She is just a genius. And I don't use the word lightly, but you'll get to meet Dr. Ariel Johnson. That's coming up next on the Good Food Hour.
Sonoma County's News Talk, KSRO, on FM at 103.5 in Santa Rosa and Windsor, and now at 96.9 in Petaluma.
Do you think simply sitting and talking to a customer would be considered a good deed for free? This is Austin from Moore Home Services, and I think it does. Our technician, Jeff, showed up to a service call for a retired veteran who lives in the country with his wife. While Jeff was working on his system, the two struck up a conversation that spanned every subject, from family to animals to world religions to the customer's military service. Jeff was thrilled to learn from the wisdom and the knowledge of the inspiring older gentleman. He later said that he felt like he knew his customer for 20 years, not 2 hours, and he was grateful for the experience. Imagine that, making a friend out of a customer. In this case, it was a mutual good deed for free. Two people connecting and enriching each other's lives. If you need plumbing, heating, or AC services, check us out at morehomeservices.com.
We do more to treat you right. More Home Services.
Hi, I'm Patty Manett, manager of the Healdsburg branch at Exchange Bank. We know that growing your business comes with a lot of hurdles. Working with an experienced banker who understands your unique business banking needs, be it a line of credit, a business loan, or merchant services, means you have a partner by your side who can help clear those hurdles. At Exchange Bank, we're here to help. Learn more at exchangebank.com.
Exchange Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. All loans subject to credit approval.
Imagine having all the money you need for retirement, all the income, every month, guaranteed. That's Secure Future Investor, an indexed annuity tied to growth in the stock market, but without any risk of loss, ever. It's guaranteed money for life income, no matter how long you live. Call 888-509-2228. 888-509-2228. Sponsored by GP Agency, Inc., Raleigh, North Carolina. Licensed in all states. Performance may vary. Consult with your financial professional before making an investment decision.
Attorney Joe Cordell.
Business owners and professionals face special challenges in divorce court. In addition to everything else going on, they have to contend with allegations that they are earning more than they are, coupled with claims on their business or practice itself. Clients with assets depend on their divorce lawyer's skills in these matters, and that's why it's so important to hire someone that has those skills.
Schedule an appointment with one of Cordell & Cordell's California area attorneys. 2121 North California Boulevard, Suite 290, Walnut Creek, California, 94596.
Children and men and women of all ages live in fear every day due to domestic violence, elder abuse, sexual assault, stalking, or human trafficking.
News Talk 1350
the Family Justice Center, Sonoma County, is here to help,
ASRO,
providing free and confidential support.
Programming
including
already
civil
in progress.
And criminal legal issues, immigration support, and more. For help or to donate, visit fjcsc.org, fjcsc.org. This message is a service of Ongaro & Sons Heating, Cooling, Plumbing, Electrical, and Solar. Because we care.
In the KSRO kitchen, I'm Steve Garner along with Chef John Ash. We've been reviewing cookbooks and talking to cookbook authors for almost 38 years on the show. And occasionally a book comes along that kind of knocks our socks off. And this is one that is brand new. It's called Flavorama, F-L-A-V-O-R-A-M-A, A Guide to Unlocking the Art and Science of Flavor. And it's by Ariel Johnson. Ariel is going to be appearing later this afternoon at Omnivore Books in San Francisco. It's on Cesar Chavez Avenue if you're in the Bay Area. Well worth hearing Ariel talk today. John, you've spent a lifetime pursuing this exact topic, lecturing on flavor at the CIA, writing extensively. So I know you'll have some very insightful questions for Ariel Johnson. Ariel, thanks for joining John and me today. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
It is our pleasure. Just a little bit about your background. You're a PhD in flavor. Is that correct?
Yeah, I did my PhD at UC Davis, and I studied flavor chemistry there.
And had you anticipated a career consulting with some of the greatest chefs in the world?
I don't necessarily think I anticipated any kind of greatness, but I got into this because I love food, I love cooking, I love working with chefs and collaborating with them. And the stuff I've been able to do with it has just been kind of an extra bonus.
So in the beginning of the book, right at the beginning of the book, you say, flavor is molecules. Can you explain that to us?
Yeah. So flavor is an experience. It exists in the brain, but it comes primarily from our sense of taste and our sense of smell. And both of those senses are what we call chemical senses. They respond by, we have receptors that bind directly to molecules that come out of our food. So where flavor is an experience, it also comes directly from molecules. So if you understand something about the molecules that are in your food, you can understand a little bit more about flavor.
You actually referenced something in the book. When I started reading, I thought, oh, boy, this is going to be a very serious book. And and the content is scientifically based, but you sprinkle so much humor in this book. It really disarmed me, I think, is the word that I would come up with. Especially in your introduction, you wrote about the 10 reasons about flavor, and you know that people will be paying exorbitant amounts of money to get heirloom tomatoes. It's all about the flavor. And then you wrote, the town where Guy Fieri lives, Flavor Town. Now, do you know that Guy Fieri made his reputation here in Santa Rosa?
I did know he was from Northern California. I didn't know Santa Rosa was the original look for him.
Yeah, he does all of his television shows here and all of that stuff. So
that was very fun. So when I got to that paragraph, I laughed and I thought, okay, this is really going to be, it's not a scientific treatise that I'm going to feel like I'm sitting in a college course. You've really been able to sprinkle humor in this, so thank you for that.
Oh, well, you're welcome, and I'm glad you thought it was funny. I'm not just irreverent. I'm a scientist. I love thinking about mechanisms, but I love having fun with it, so I don't see why the two should not go together as much as possible.
So there's so much controversy often about flavor and taste and smell and the fact that some people don't like certain flavors, tastes, smells, all of that stuff. Can you explain why that is? I mean, are we just genetically set up for that?
we're kind of genetically and neurobiologically, I guess, set up to have strong ties between emotions and memories of our experiences and our perception of flavor. So it's not so much that we're wired to have controversy, but to have strong opinions and strong feelings about flavor. So every time that we eat something, experience a flavor, we tend to store whatever emotions we had in that moment with that flavor and recall it the next time that we experience that flavor.
Well, and so much of it, doesn't it have to do with memory? Pleasant memories, childhood memories, all of that stuff influence greatly what we like and what we don't like.
Oh, yeah, huge amounts. I mean, I think of our sense of flavor as kind of a neutral tool or like a blank canvas where it's not necessarily set at the beginning what flavors are going to be good for us, what flavors are going to be related to good food or unhealthy food or food that hurts us. But we are set up to figure that out and store those reactions as strong emotions and memories, starting from the very beginning, you know, in our childhood.
So I have a question that I'll ask you. When people talk about flavor and taste, they often quote, and it took a while for us to get there. It used to be the four flavors or tastes, and then it became five with the addition of umami. Mm-hmm. There is a sixth one, which you kind of put in a category of its own, and that is spicy.
Yeah, so when we're talking about taste and being very technical about it, a taste is something that we sense with a taste receptor cell on our tongue inside of a taste bud. So we have cells for sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and umami. Spicy is a sensation that is absolutely a part of flavor, but we don't actually sense it with our taste system. The feeling of spiciness, the flavor of spiciness, is the feeling of our pain receptors being activated by components of things like chilies or black pepper. So spicy is a very important part of flavor, but it is technically a sense of touch.
Give us the five core laws.
Well, so yes, flavor is molecules, which we already touched on. Flavor is taste and smell. Flavor follows predictable patterns. Flavor can be concentrated, extracted, and infused, and flavor can be created and transformed. And so most of those follow basically chemical things that flavors always do. So flavor is always molecules. Flavor is always taste and smell, and as we just said, sometimes touch. If you were to make a cup of coffee or a chicken stock or even to juice an orange, you're extracting, infusing, or concentrating flavors by moving different components of those ingredients around. And then, of course, since flavor is molecules, we can also do chemical reactions. So okay. Things like browning, smoking, grilling, as well as culturing and lactic fermentation are all processes that will chemically change ingredients and in the process create new flavors at a molecular level.
So you make the comment that smell is the overlooked sense, typically. Why do you say that?
Well, so two reasons. One is that it's not always really immediately obvious to people that smell is an important part of flavor. Part of this is because the brain actually kind of tricks you into perceiving the sensation of smell during flavor as happening inside your mouth. So you kind of don't have a chance to think about it being smell at all. The other part of that is that even going back to Greek philosophy, there was a lot of writing on the senses, and people were very focused on vision as being important, but would often write off the sense of smell as being, the weakest and basest and most animalistic and least noble of the senses. And I think
really?
Go back to Aristotle in De Anima. He is not a big fan of smell, unfortunately.
But we're so seduced by smell. You can be at the airport and smell donuts cooking or things like that, and immediately become hungry. It seems to be a powerful sense.
Oh, it's extremely powerful. And as modern science has gotten kind of deeper into our genetic code and things like that, we've actually discovered that the genes that we use to sense smell, so we produce smell receptors. We have one gene for each of those receptors, and there are about 400 of those. That actually makes the olfactory receptor family the largest family of genes in the human genome. So we dedicate a lot of genetic information for this ability.
Well, you mentioned you can smell way more things than we can taste.
Yeah.
compared to that. Let me tell you. Let me tell you the line in your book that made me fall in love with you and your book. Here's what you wrote. You said, "I wrote this. Gosh, I love this book. I wrote this in my notes." That you hear someone, "Oh, well, they've got a very good palate. They've got a good palate. Oh, this needs more acidity. Oh, yes. Oh, yes." You wrote, "This is mostly," and I can't see the word on the radio, but I'll say BS, but you spelled it out. And you wrote that we're all built to taste and smell. Most of us are just in need of practice. That was very encouraging.
Oh, good. I hope so. I think especially if you're at a wine tasting or a coffee cupping or some other, environment like that, it can be very intimidating to be around people that have a lot of practice describing what they taste and what they smell to the point where it makes you feel as a beginner like that's something I could never do. But in my experience as a lab scientist, to do flavor chemistry, we actually have to not only measure molecules, but get human subjects to taste things and describe what they taste very precisely. And we have to train them often from zero to be able to do this. So I have seen over and over people who were not very confident tasters go through, practice, repetition, paying attention, and eventually become, really, really quite confident and pretty precise at describing what flavors they're experiencing. So.
You talk in the book about, and I'm aware that there are many aroma wheels, which I guess are there to help us put words to what it is we're encountering. But I know there's a coffee aroma wheel, certainly a wine aroma wheel. It kind of goes on and on. Are those really valuable for people?
The cheese wheel.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, I think they're extremely valuable. I believe the wine aroma wheel developed by Ann Noble at UC Davis actually was the first one, if I recall correctly. And I think the place where that's really helpful is that in tasting, we sometimes describe the tip of the nose or the tip of the tongue phenomenon, where you can recognize a flavor and you know what it is, but you just can't find the right words for it. So an aroma wheel will often have like higher level categories like fruity or spices. And then, within those categories have cherry, blackberry, raspberry, or clove and fennel and cinnamon. And thinking in that kind of systematic way and having just like a little bit of help to get on the precise descriptor is incredibly useful for people as they are learning how to describe what they are experiencing.
So how does this information help me become a better cook?
Well, so I think of understanding, the sort of underlying mechanisms of food and of cooking and of flavor as the difference. If you can follow a recipe, but you don't really know why it's working, it's a bit like being able to follow the turn-by-turn GPS on your phone when you're driving your car.
That's good.
But if Waze goes down or your phone's battery dies, it's the difference between only being able to do that and then understanding, the layout of your city well enough that you can develop your own route and understand where you're going. So
I was fascinated with the, you call it your part four, which is the fourth law of flavor, that flavor can be created and transformed by by heating, by fermenting, by doing those
smoking.
Kinds of smoking. Mm-hmm. I mean, taking some active steps to really develop flavor. And if I'm one who loves fermented foods or loves smoked foods or something, I would probably really focus in on those things, like how do I get more of that?
Yeah, I mean, knowing what ingredients can develop which flavors, for something like caramelization, if you want to get a caramelized flavor, all you really need is sugar. But other types of browning, like in coffee, roasted chicken, that is actually the domain of something called the Maillard reaction. Mm-hmm. And for that, you also need amino acids. So, you know, even just knowing the kind of basics of, like, well, if I want, you know, these more toasty flavors, I do need to have some protein in there as opposed to just sugar. That immediately opens up a lot more opportunities than kind of stumbling around blindly hoping that you get something that you like.
Now, John hopscotched from part one all the way to part four.
Yeah. Well,
but that's okay, because he's
you don't have to eat it linearly, and I don't really think very linearly, so definitely fine with me.
Well, the fourth law of flavor, that was part four, flavor can be created and transformed. And you're right, if there was just one chapter, and you had only written this one chapter as a book, I would have been thrilled just to read this, just from the Maillard bunch that you wrote about, the whole food guide, the world of browning. That was just so important. And that, again, your humor came through. You said that to get all that moisture evaporated, which retards Maillard, right? You're not going to get as good a browning without that. You can do it like Marcella Hazan does. She uses a hair dryer.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
To make sure every molecule of water has been evaporated before she starts to quest for browning.
Well, and then it also helps us understand cooking terms like the fond, you know, that I love that when chefs talk about that, it's like, well, it's that brown stuff on the bottom of the pan that you add a liquid to and then stir up. And that's the fond, where all the flavor is.
Yeah. We'll take a very, very quick break, about 2.5 minutes. Stay with us. We'll be right back for a conversation with Ariel Johnson. This is the book, Flavorama, A Guide to Unlocking the Art and Science of Flavor. It looks like with some 99 recipes, it's just out. And if you want to talk with Ariel and see her in person, she's at Omnivore Books in San Francisco starting at 3 o'clock this afternoon. It's on Cesar Chavez Street. It'll be well worth seeing. You can get, I assume, an autographed copy of the book. Is that right, Ariel?
Yes, I will be signing books. So happy to sign your copy if you're there.
Fabulous. We'll be right back right after these messages. I'm Steve Garner and Chef John Ash in the KSRO Kitchen.
The Ramsey Show, Saturday and Sunday afternoons, 3 to 6 on KSRO, is brought to you by Cobran Financial. Can you retire? Find out with Cobran Financial.
Hi, it's Dennis from the Santa Rosa Original Certified Farmers Market at Luther Burbank Center. I'd like to talk a bit about our market. Sure, we have great coffee, crepes, salsa, sausage, fruits, veggies, crafts, and much, much more. But to me, it's what you can't buy that makes the market special, and that's the people. You may have heard me speak with Steve on Saturday mornings on Garden Talk about buying potatoes from Tom or mushrooms from Barbara, forgetting to mention their business names. This is due to the relationships developed with those who grow the food we eat, something you can't get at the big supermarket chains. The vendors are a great resource to help create the perfect meal for you and your family. Bring your kids, grab a bite and something to drink, and shop the farmers market voted the best farmers market in Sonoma County 2 years running in the Press Democrats Readers Poll. We've been doing this for 50 years. We must be doing something right. So come and visit us at the Santa Rosa Original Certified Farmers Market, Wednesdays and Saturdays, 8:30 to 1.
Ungaro & Sons is your trusted home services provider in the North Bay. Their reputation is built on 4 generations of providing quality plumbing, heating, cooling, and electrical solutions. They offer upfront pricing and a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Ungaro & Sons is the name you've trusted for over 90 years. So now that you're ready to take control of your energy future with solar, you know who to call. Visit ungaroandsons.com today to find out more. Industry-leading equipment from Enphase, REC, Tesla, Franklin, and more. Installed by highly skilled licensed electricians. Reduce your power bills and gain independence from the traditional power grid while increasing the value of your property. And for a limited time, enjoy 10 years of free solar panel cleaning and maintenance. Ungaro & Sons. Plumbing, heating, cooling, electrical, and solar. Book your appointment online at ungaroandsons.com. O-N-G-A-R-O and sons.com.
Country Summer, presented by Bud Light, June 14th, 15th, and 16th at the Sonoma County Fairgrounds, with Friday's lineup headlined by Old Dominion.
She kept the hotel key. Gotta love, like there's no such thing as a broken heart. Life is short, make it sweet.
along with Jody Messina.
Heads Carolina, tails California, somewhere greener, somewhere warmer.
And Cameron Marlowe. Little Big Town, headline Saturday, and Jordan Davis Sunday on the Chevy Silverado stage. Brought to you by Bud Light, Bay Area Chevy dealers, Redwood Credit Union, Kendall Jackson Wines, River Rock Casino, Tito's Handmade Vodka, Sonoma Clean Power, and Jack Daniels. Live freely, drink responsibly. Country Summer's 10th anniversary, June 14th to 16th. Single day tickets and 3 day passes on sale now at countrysummer.com.
KSRO, AM, FM, and online. Depend on it.
Steve Garner and Chef John Ash in the KSRO kitchen chatting with Ariel Johnson. Ariel's new book is called Flavorama, a guide to unlocking the art and science of flavor with 99 plus recipes. We wanted to jump up to the salt and sour chapter, if you don't mind, Ariel. I think that's pretty important, don't you, John?
Mm-hmm.
And why, to you, is salt one of the keys? And also, you said after salt, sour is the most important one to try to master.
Yeah, well, so salt, you know, for anyone who's been around a professional kitchen, you know, in Western cooking at least, salt is so fundamental to properly flavoring food that we just call it seasoning. Salt is sort of the building block that the other tastes rest on. And, you know, saltiness can't really be imitated by any other flavors. So it is kind of essential to get right. And it helps wake up our perception of tastes and of smells, and really adds kind of liveliness to our cooking. And, you know, after salt, sour does that the most. So I think, you know, when I'm talking to people about cooking and when I'm cooking myself, sometimes the first issue that comes up is like, well, it tastes flat. It's not exciting or bright enough. And the two things, salt first and then sourness, are the two tastes that really help amp those things up and add liveliness and interest to food.
So in recent years, we've gone off on salt and put it on everything, on sweet things, on ice cream and all of that stuff, which was certainly not part of my growing up years, the thought of putting salt on caramel ice cream was not...
And chocolate.
Where did that come from?
Well, so interestingly, in addition to just being delicious on its own, so you're talking about caramel, you're talking about chocolate. Both of those flavors have a little bit of bitterness to them. And besides tasting salty, salt has a very interesting feature where it can actually interfere with our bitter taste receptors. Bitter tasting molecules don't bind as tightly to them, and our perception of bitterness is reduced when we taste salt along with bitterness. So bitterness can be reduced, and then things actually taste a little bit sweeter when we put salt on them.
Well, you made the point that a little salt gives a, kind of a multi-dimension to whatever it's being put on. So it makes it more intriguing, interesting. I don't know what the word is there, but...
Dynamic, perhaps. And, you know, yeah. Of course, like, this is new in some American kitchens, but then in Brittany and France and other places, salted caramel has been a tradition for a long time. So I guess, you know, in America, we've rediscovered this as a delicious combination.
So you include a little thing that says, try this, a good trick. If you're serving chocolate ice cream or a chocolate mousse, drizzle a little bit of the best olive oil you can find over it, then sprinkle on some flaky salt.
Wow. Sounds good, doesn't it?
Well, so that will, you know, do all of the decreasing bitterness, increasing sweetness. But since you are adding oil on top of the chocolate mousse and then adding salt to the oil. Salt and oil do not mix. Salt is like water. Water and oil don't mix. So you'll actually retain the kind of crunchy crystallinity of the salt that way. So it adds a kind of like textural as well as taste excitement to a dish.
In the sour chapter, I was surprised to read right at the top of your acidity chart is one of my new favorite adoptees for flavor, and that's pomegranate molasses.
Yeah, so pomegranate molasses, you know, takes pomegranate juice, which is a fairly sour juice, and then cooks it over a low flame, evaporating the water away and concentrating it down into a syrup. And, you know, the acid molecules in pomegranate juice do not boil away, so they concentrate to actually quite a high acidity percentage. Yeah.
That was a great chapter. John and I were intrigued by the bitter chapter, and you said that's the most divisive of all. Explain that.
Well, so with the five tastes, there is a pretty like strong evolutionary component to why we can sense each of them. So we can taste salt because we need to take in sodium for our cells to work. We can taste sweet because it's an easy source of calories, so that's handy. Bitterness, on the other hand, is a intentionally aversive taste. It is there to sense potential poisons and toxins. So generally, we have, from the beginning, a strong inducement to dislike things that are bitter, generally.
So what about Campari and soda?
I couldn't live without Campari and soda in my life. How come I like that? But when you say, do you like bitter things, I would say, no, I don't.
So, you often hear the concept of an acquired taste, and bitter foods are very much a scientific example of acquired taste. Going back to ancient philosophies on medicine, we hear concepts like the dose defines the poison. So some things that can be toxic in high doses can actually be quite beneficial in lower doses. There's lots of like medicinal compounds in plants that taste quite bitter, or plants that taste bitter that we can get lots of vitamins and things from. So, you know, there's kind of a balance where, like, we don't want to eat too many things that are bitter because that can hurt us. But there are situations where it's beneficial for us to be able to eat bitter things. So, you know, this is a place where our sense of memory and learning and emotion really comes in, where the first few times we taste a bitter food like Campari or beer or dark chocolate, we tend to dislike it because it's bitter and we're naturally averse to bitterness. But then if nothing bad happens to us from eating it, we'll start to sort of store a memory of like the bitterness along with, you know, the chocolatey flavors or the coffee flavors or the Campari flavors.
We're down to the last couple of minutes. This 35 minutes, we knew it wasn't going to be enough. Might you be available for a continued chat at another time, Ariel?
Oh, I would love that. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, this was really exciting. Flavorama, A Guide to Unlocking the Art and Science of Flavor by Ariel Johnson, PhD in Flavor. She's appearing this afternoon at Omnivore Books in San Francisco on Cesar Chavez Boulevard at 3 o'clock. You can meet her, and regardless of whether you can catch her talk this afternoon, check out Flavorama at your local bookstore. It's worth looking at. Thank you again, Ariel. It was delightful to talk with you.
Yeah, this is super fun. I can't wait to do it again.
Okay, we will do that. John Ash, thanks a million.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Back after this.
Freedom discussed.
It's about time we face the facts over gun control.
KSRO, Sonoma County's News Talk.
North Bay Honor Flight is a Santa Rosa-based nonprofit whose mission is to transport our local veterans to visit their memorials in Washington, D.C. at no cost to the honored veteran. The goal is to honor the service of our Vietnam, Korea, and World War II veterans and give them the warm and celebratory homecoming they deserved but never received. Right now, we need volunteers and donations. Please join us in giving our veterans one final tour with honor. Go to NorthBayHonorFlight.org. NorthBayHonorFlight.org.
It's game day at Jim's house, and the spread is impressive.
Mike's already done some damage with the hot wings, and now he's dropping back and going deep for another slice of pizza.
I sure hope he brought the Pepto.
Mike knows the Pepto-Bismol provides fast, five-symptom relief from unexpected stomach upsets. He's no rookie.
The way he's throwing back those nachos, he's the GOAT.
Be ready for game day with Pepto.